Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. This is a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, July 15th, 2021. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. She is Jeff O'Neill.
Ooh.
That's how this works, right?
Little Freaky Friday action.
Little role play. That's how we did it. We're talking about book stuff this week. Rebecca, how are you?
I'm good. And now I'm imagining like an updated version of the Tom Hanks movie Big, where if I wake up tomorrow and I'm you, I did grow like 14 inches.
It will be quite different. My daughter is 8, and so she is tall enough where she's not like a toddler, right? Where literally the whole world is the wrong size, mm-hmm. where she's just tall enough that like getting on the stool and getting up into the cabinets means she can break things. And I'm wondering like, where is she going to start topping out? Like she's 8, so she's got a ways to go. Mm-hmm. My son's quite tall. Michelle, my partner, she's 5'7". But I was like, is she going to be a foot shorter than I am? Because that's a lot different.
A foot shorter
is a lot different.
When you were saying getting up onto the stool and climbing on the cabinets, I was like, this is relatable. I did that yesterday.
we have a big wall in our living room that is all bookcases now, but we're going to have built-ins that go floor to ceiling, wall to wall. It can be nice. And when Michelle was penciling it out, she's like, do you think we need a ladder? I'm like, a ladder? What are you talking about? It's like, to get to the top ones. I'm like, what do you? And I stood over there and realized that I could reach up and get into what would be the top shelf, but it won't be easy for everyone. So all Jeff's books go on the top. That's how we're going to handle that. We don't need a ladder because a ladder is built into this particular
That's
unit,
where so. The Busman's MBA library can go that nobody else wants
That's right. And my Norton anthologies from grad school, British literature to 1500, not going to pull that one off.
Whatever else you've been holding on to since your insufferable 15-year-old reading days, like that, I think all that can go up there. Yeah.
That would be a good category to have people look at their bookshelves and like, what are the things that you're never going to read again, nor access, but you can't quit, to use the Brokeback parlance, they become part of the firmament. Of your book collection.
Yeah, you cart them from house to house. Yeah, we are doing some of that in my house right now because we had to sort through books on kind of a surprise notice a few weeks ago when there are bats in my chimney again. And they like to fly down the chimney and into the house through the fireplace. We thought that this problem has been solved. I know way more about bats now than I want to know. But Bob's solution to keep the bats in the chimney until the bat people can come responsibly remove them when they're no longer babies, because that's a whole situation, is fill up the fireplace with books and then tape the opening closed with cardboard boxes. So we were like going through our bookshelves, pulling off like, what are we willing from our bookshelves to stick into the fireplace with bats? And what is too safe? Like, what is too safe?
Our bat forward collection. Our vanguard of books to protect us against the rodents of the air.
Right. And there was stuff. There's stuff at the back of our bookshelves. We've been in this house for 14 years that was like, oh, I don't even remember the version of myself that put this book on the bookshelf. Like, that's going in the bat cave. The Marilyn Robinsons are safe in the living room.
That's a moment. That's a liminal category. I don't want to get rid of them, but it's okay if bats crap all over them.
Right. And like, when the bats are removed and we get to go through the ones that we've put into the fireplace, which ones will we still want to save? And which ones is it like, oh, you've been living with bats for a couple months and now we're fine with you exiting our house. Like, so if you need a way to weed your bookshelves, friends, I invite you to get bats. You'll never get rid of them.
Or just imagine, just go through the exercise of, say I was being invaded by an invasive species tomorrow.
Right.
What would be
rodents.
My bulwark? That first line of defense can go. Though, and again, you don't have your bulwark. Then what are you going to use? Your second line
right.
of defense.
You know, probably.
So you do need those.
Probably the like Scion selection that I made was Bob had a copy of that Tucker Max book from like 1999 that I don't know why that book has gotten carted around with us for 20 years. I understand why like an 18-year-old Bob would have read it. I was like, well, this is going in the fireplace.
I think it's kind of like how you kind of are proud of your scars, you know, from where you came from, you right. know, as a reminder of how bad it can go and how you don't want to go back there.
Right, right.
Yeah, something like that. Well, best of luck with your bat fortress.
I should take a picture of it, but I'm afraid to untape the cardboard for fear of that, like, it'll just be a bat stream coming into my house.
I think the bats like it because there's, like, reading material now. This chimney's great. This one comes with a library, guys.
Honestly, Jeff, I think the Harry Potters are in there.
Oh. That's a metaphor in the chimney right there. That's what
maybe
we're talking about.
When the bat guys come to do the removal, I'll take a picture that we can drop into show notes. For anybody who's interested in the book fortress.
Very interested myself in what this looks like. All right, let's do a sponsor break and we'll come back and talk about things that aren't about being terrified and harassed by creatures of the night.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumis, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now, her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode.
Up first. I don't know. Do you remember there's that one, I think it's a Parks and Rec or something, where Anne's like, there's no way to say congrats without saying sarcastic. It's like, congrats, congrats, congrats. It all sounds sarcastic. I feel like sometimes I give our listeners and ourselves a hard time about listener feedback, but this is meant to be completely irony-free, that we got a lot of really helpful feedback about historical fiction and what it is and what it isn't. So what I'm going to do, Rebecca, if you'll indulge me and us, is present to you some of the clarifications, qualifications, boundaries, smears, and fuzziness that got introduced into the, I'll now call the historical fiction spectrum, a grand unified theory of the historical fiction spectrum. And I would like to propose the following, that historical fiction is like any other genre that, frankly, at some level, kind of doesn't matter, right? We're not talking about, you know, all kinds of things.
If genre your is a mileage social construction may vary, anyway.
If you want to do some different construction or not, I think what's useful here is, like all language, we want to use the word so that when we use it, someone else understands what we're talking about. Yes. So that if I describe something as historical fiction, I recommend a book to someone who's like, yeah, it's historical fiction. They're like, why did the hell did you give this to me? Like that, we want to be kind of in the middle of the bear curve. The bear curve is something else. The middle of the bell curve about the meaning of historical fiction. You'll be in the middle of the electron cloud for the nucleus of historical fiction. So having said that, I'd like to propose, and I'm not going to give every, not everyone included their name, and there was a bunch of repeats, but there's a couple that I thought, well, there's actually a bunch. One, and I think I'm going to start with one that I think is pretty easy to understand, is that if it was contemporary when it was written, it doesn't mean it's historical fiction 100 years later, right? Dickens right. is not historical fiction because Dickens was writing about contemporary London, Paris. I guess maybe there's some stuff that's a little bit earlier, but if it's within, you know, if they would have been contemporary at the time, or generally should be contemporary, not historical fiction now. Makes yes, complete sense to me. Totally. Do you agree with that?
It does, because okay. the author was not writing about history. The author was yeah. writing about the present. Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, the question is, what does present mean for the writing? So, let's see. Sybil, I think, has given permission before to use their name, so I'm going to say Sybil says, not only that, but it has to be before the living memory of the author.
Oh.
So, for you and me, well, I guess the 70s are not in, to go back to Mary Jane. Oh, which by the way, I don't know, this is a weird, well, let me come back to that. Let me come back to Mary Jane in just a second. I'm so
sorry. So much is happening.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm trying to, you know, keep it light, keep it punchy, keep it moving. So the 70s for me, even though I was born in 78, would, I could write about 1979, say, according to Sybil's definition, and that could be historical fiction because I wasn't around, I didn't know enough about 1979 oh. to ever write about it contemporaneously.
So it's a moving target based on the author's age. That's interesting.
Well, it almost, I think that flows from the first one, which if they're writing contemporaneously about their time, then when does it not become contemporaneously? Is it the moment they die? Is it, and when does contemporaneous begin and when does it end? I think is pretty interesting is what Sybil's entered into the fray here,
so like,
which I haven't really thought about.
I guess I have a, I think that's interesting. And I have like a half quibble maybe. Like if, I don't know, someone who, I mean, Carl Marlantes lived through the Vietnam War and wrote Matterhorn. And so since that was in his living memory, Matterhorn is not historical fiction. But
I think I would agree with that. I'm trying to read from your voice if you're agreeing with that as it comes out of your
mouth. I'm not even sure. I don't know what I... Yeah, but if I wrote Matterhorn based on research, it would be historical fiction?
That's a pretty weird idea. I hadn't thought about that. If you had somehow recreated you and your infinite monkeys in the pursuit of writing Hamlet, accidentally wrote Matterhorn, which is statistically just as likely as writing Hamlet, which is a weird thought experiment... By Sybil's definition, yes, that would be historical fiction, or at least it would get through the first couple of slices of Swiss cheese towards the center of historical fiction.
That doesn't feel right to me. That okay. like that the content could be functionally the same, but it would be classified differently just based on the author's experience with the content. Huh.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess now the other piece, some more pieces of Swiss cheese. So you have to be the mouse that finds its way through a couple.
Are you
pieces
moving
here.
My cheese, Jeff? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, we should write a book about that. It might sell. that not only does it need to be for some people. I guess now we're getting towards more and more constraints, right? And okay. we can maybe reorder the constraints how we want to. Is not only does it have to be outside the living memory of the author, but also. That the historiness needs to be palette forward to some degree, right?
Okay.
That it is set in a different time is a feature rather than incidental to the book, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So like not every book set in 1920 is a historical fiction book about the Roaring Twenties. Some of them are
right.
just about people who are living lives and they happen to be living lives in the 20s.
And a couple people, or maybe just one person wrote, even to the point in which the setting is the main character and the characters in action are weirdly the backdrop from spending time in, say, 1908 Paris or Russia in during the Bolshevik Revolution or something else like that. That
yeah.
You need character and you need story. But the reason you came for the hang is the setting and the place in its relationship to history, first and foremost.
And maybe then the story is kind of defined by the
yes.
setting. You're reading a story about, I guess for some reason I'm on bootleggers today in the Roaring Twenties, but like if you're reading a story about like bootleggers in Atlantic City in the 1920s. That's a story that kind of only take place in the 1920s. Right. It's defined by that time. It's not just a, I don't know, domestic lit fic about people sitting around thinking thoughts that they're thinking in 1920.
Yeah, and I don't know. That might be even stranger still. Not only that, the history and the setting has to be primary among the attractions, but maybe even if you sort of took the characters and events, you couldn't transplant them because there would be some sort of plot or structural problem that would disappear, or other things would come in that would mean we just have a completely different story now, right?
So sure. Okay.
I think that resonance was something I wasn't able to articulate myself in a different way.
I like that one.
Let's see. How about adding, so this is no affirmative consent here, so you'll know who I'm talking about, reader, and thank you for your feedback, listener. Distinguish between historical and retro, which I thought was interesting, as an intermediary term. Well, Mary Jane maybe sounds like it's more retro than it is historical, because it's sort of within the cultural memory of the moment.
Yeah.
Like, not just you as a reader, but like within the larger culture's memory. So basically, that would get us to our World War II, maybe, is our liminal point, because a lot of World War II veterans and people who lived with World War II, they're nearing the end of their lives. So we're approaching the point in which all World War II fiction is going to be historical. But there was a big there was a long swath of time when it really wasn't. And maybe that's what we're feeling like it is, and it could be right now, because it is within the living memory of many people who are still alive. And so that, I think that's sort of broadening out from the author or the reader's own living memory to sort of where we are as a culture. What do you think about that idea?
I like this introduction of nuance to the scale. I think it's helpful to consider this is retro fiction. And like, I haven't read Mary Jane yet, but to use that example, it kind of sounds like a story that in a lot of ways could happen in a bunch of different decades, but some of the set pieces are, or like some of the details are about that time period.
Yeah.
So if it's colored by the time period but not defined by the time period, maybe that's like retro or historically infused. I don't know. Here's a shrub of history to infuse your cocktail. I know you love a shrub.
Oh boy. So the examples that this person gave were Stranger Things, right? That's retro.
Yes.
But it's not historical fiction, which sounds bang on to me.
Yeah, and I think there's like a quality to retro that's different from historical fiction, where retro is like celebratory of all the bells and whistles of a particular time period. Like in the Stranger Things example, you know, it's like just a deep and joyful expression of like all the stuff that was in pop culture at that moment. And retro seems to generally be about that, you know?
Yeah. And a further wrinkle here in terms of like, you know, how you might how you might get some feeling around what the cultural living memory looks like. Think about the birth of your grandparents. For a lot of us, it's kind of the earliest point in cultural living memory that we have access to, right? Mm-hmm. You know, most of us don't have access to our great grandparents in a meaningful way for most of our lives. But our grandparents' story is sort of part of our story. So by definition, almost their story cannot be historical, because it is at the very least a forward or preamble to our own experience, and you can hear firsthand stories. I think there's a firsthandedness that's interesting. If it's firsthand somehow, or could be firsthand by someone who's living, it's very hard for it to be capital H, capital F historical fiction. Because capital H, capital F historical fiction is anyone who lived through this is long dead, right? I mean, I think there's maybe a very simple way of thinking about it that way in terms of very strict definition of historical. Historical fiction, yeah.
I can get on board with that. I know one of our contributors, it might have even been our editor, Danica, said that her definition, of historical fiction is if people who were alive at the time that the book is set are adults now, it's historical fiction. And I was like, you mean a book that was just like something that happened 18 years ago would be historical fiction? And Danica, I love you, but I can't get down with that.
Yeah. Let's see. So the detailedness is also interesting. I think that's related to whether or not the historical setting or an action is forward, right? You're going to get a lot more detail about the specifics of daily life in historical fiction than in something contemporary, because in contemporary, it's sort of taken as read. Like, you're not going to do a lot of explaining if you're writing a book set today about what an iPhone is and how it works,
because
your assumption is everyone knows it. Where if you're writing a book where you need to use, you know, rotary dial telephones or telegrams to understand what the limits are and what they can and can't do and how they work, you got to spend a little, you have to linger a little bit on the machinations of the machine to explain what is relevant there. So that's an easy way to tell, is like, if the writer is writing whereas you understand how the world works, that's almost by definition contemporary. So Jane Austen, for example. When I was teaching Jane Austen, you had to explain, you can get through without explaining a lot, but you need to explain some stuff about like how much people were paid, how much money was worth, like what happens when Father Bennet dies, and then what happens in entailment, and who's the crown, and what. But if you're reading contemporarily, you already know, it's like baked into your knowledge. And at some point, there are liminal cases where people know different things, and that's sort of the grandparents' birth. I think becomes a useful test. Is like, there are probably a lot of things that your grandparents' life you do understand, and a lot of them you don't understand. But go back a generation too, it's really a different world. And so the writing and reading project becomes materially different to get someone up to speed, as it were. So a lot of people are trying to say, I think 60, I think 80. I think a lot of people are trying to capture of what is before living cultural memory look like. So I thought that
really
was
helpful,
pretty interesting too.
It.
I'm going to end here because we did, this is maybe the strict, well, I don't know if it's the strictest, but from historical fiction in quotation from someone who works cataloging books,
ooh,
right? So you got to actually make decisions.
Yes. Tell us.
So we'll end here. Do I have permission? No, it doesn't look like. I'm going to read this because I think it makes sense to do this. I'm a cataloging librarian. Sometimes I have to answer this question for my job. However, keep in mind that this is the sort of thing that is a very individual library decision. For us, it means this person's library. It means adding a historical fiction sticker to the spine of a book in the fiction collection. First, something was bugging me, but maybe I wasn't listening close enough. But at first I thought you were ambiguating being written in a time with being set in a time. Okay, we talked about this before, so we'll move past that. It didn't, written in the time, no, you're out. Second, you hit the nail on the head that it needs to be very directly connected to historical events, not just set in the past. So coming of age in the 19th century may not be historical fiction, but coming of age in the coming of age of Winston Churchill's daughter is. I do tend to look for mentions of specific historical figures and or events in the book's description. So that's pretty strict. Like, it has to be pegged to sort of like a, I don't know, a push pin of history somehow that people recognize as a marker.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. Like, if you could transport these characters into a different time and not change the story, it's not really historical fiction. But you can't transport Winston Churchill's grandchild or whatever to a different.
Yeah, there's just a kid, right? You know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
That person's not that interesting.
Yeah.
And then the third, which you'll be happy with, but again, this is just how my library has done it, and at some point we'll have to change this boundary, I'm sure, but we haven't so far. World War II and early are capital H, capital F historical fiction. More recent than that is not. Of course, this guideline was probably instituted long ago, certainly before I got this job in 2012, but this library has only existed since the late 70s, so not before that. But that is how it currently is. A little unclear, were they this library cataloging World War II as historical fiction in the late 70s, which would be pretty weird to me.
And
that would abrogate some of our lines here.
What kind of excellent record keeping do they have if that was their policy in the 70s and they still know it today is what I want to know.
Yeah. And I think the library catalog is a really good test case because it's very practical. You're trying to communicate to something with readers and have them understand what you're getting. You don't want to put something, a label on historical fiction that isn't, so that you don't turn people off who say, I don't like historical fiction. Also, so that people who are actively looking for it sort of get, they understand what's on the tin, and what's on the tin is describing the thing that's in the tin.
Yeah, I think this is all really helpful. And now I'm thinking about my own idiosyncratic reading preferences, but I don't like a lot of historical fiction because I don't build worlds very well in my head, and I want to like get to what's going on with the character, and a lot of detail around like setting and how the telegram works and stuff is like just not that's just not my jam. So that distinction of like it, that it needs to be defined in some way by these historical figures. There are folks who are the, like the exact opposite of me, and they really want the stories that are infused with all of that. And I think this way of thinking about how do you mark those books so people find what they're looking for, or like don't end up getting surprised by historical fiction when they right. thought they were just getting a book that was set in 1950 or whatever, is really useful.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way too. I like history. I would rather read the biography of Belle da Costa Green. No, I'm serious. Than yeah, no, you know, I, Murray Benedict's new book that is a historical fiction novel about Belle da Costa Green. I'm sure it's good and seems to be selling well. We haven't talked about this, but if I'm going to choose, I'd, you know, give me the history if I want. Give me the Stephen Johnson if I want to know how phones worked in 1920. But give me what fiction does better, or which fiction is especially good at, or you can't get in history. When I'm going for
that's
my fiction.
Where but, I am too.
You know, A Gentleman in Moscow, I didn't think I'd be into. Finally got around to it, bought it for a deal. I loved it. I freaking love Gentleman in Moscow. Pretty hardcore historical fiction, but wonderful characterizations. It gave me both. I think maybe that's the thing, is much like a lot of genre reading, capital G genre, I don't like the thing that is just the thing. I like if it crosses over or does something a little bit more. And this is not a surprise to anyone who's listening to the show that both of us are maybe more interested in those kinds of things. But thank you all for your historical fiction contributions. I think we learned. I think we helped some people here today, Rebecca. They helped us help people.
Yeah, it definitely helped us. That was really interesting. And I'm super grateful that folks had nuanced ways of thinking about this thing where we were just like, this doesn't feel right, but what would be right? And how would we arrive at right? And it turns out that someone has already thought about that.
Right. And so without having read Mary Jane, I think it could go either way. Well, it's within the living memory. So if that's the one you care about, only, or maybe it's one you need three of five or something like that. Maybe it's not a spectrum, but like it could be super detail oriented. It's on my Kindle. It's up next. I said this last week, but I haven't gotten to it yet. If it's super about like the specifics of being a record store nerd, I think it could, in my mind, categorize as historical fiction, even though it's certainly within my grandparents' living memory. It's within my parents' memory. I was even born during it.
Right.
The author, who I don't have the name in front of me, I don't know her age, but this could be her reminiscing about her 14-year-old self. But if it's really into the details of what it was like to listen to records in the 70s, maybe if it does that one thing enough, it can break through the surface tension and be historical fiction for some people. So I don't know. Maybe there's five dials, and if three of them, and they all go to 10, and if in aggregate the score is 31, you know, your mileage may vary how this course. I think that's another way of thinking about it. It's not just a spectrum of it needs to have X, Y, or Z, but like, out of how many possible historical fiction points does it score? And at a certain number, it's like a lot of people would agree that's historical fiction. Useful. Especially as I think we said last time, Book Riot starting a historical fiction newsletter dedicated to historical fiction. It's called Past Tense, coming out in September. One thing we've seen over the last years is historical fiction becoming a much more commercial fiction space in a lot of ways, like we would reserve for like mysteries or thrillers or suspense novels. The historical fiction space sells some books, whether the tattooist of Auschwitz is one. Of course, the Kristen Hannah project is largely a historical fiction one. Those books sell, and we got a lot of copycats and knockoffs. And well, I don't think it's fair to call it, but some other books and trends have come under the tent that has been placed and built and kept up. So the historical fiction as a thing that people think about more is definitely more out there. The thing I was going to say about Mary Jane, this is a weird one. It's live on Book Riot Deals today, but Mary Jane just came out May 11th. It seems to be selling pretty well. I've seen a lot of people talking about, for whatever reason, right now it's for sale for $5.99 on Kindle, which is weird. It's a weird price and a weird time.
That's a weird price.
So for those of you who follow the deal world at all with ebooks, usually while the book is in hardcover, you're not going to get a deal. It's going to be $14.99 or $13.99 or $11.99. And I'm looking at commercial literary fiction, which is why I tend to buy. Kids, young adult, other things might vary. Sometimes at the end of its hardcover cycle, as it's coming into paperback, you might get a week-long down price of something. You might get $2.99 this week, and then the paperback comes out, and then the Kindle version goes back up. And then once it's been in paperback for a while and it's now backlist, every now and again, most books will go on sale for $2 or $3. I don't know how these are decided. I don't know what the calendar are. Trust me, I have asked the people who would know how to know what's coming, how the decision being made. I can't get a straight answer, and that's fine. Maybe there's not a straight answer to be had. This one doesn't follow any of those things because the general gulf is between like the full Kindle price and like a few bucks, usually topping out $4.99. Mary Jane at $5.99, that's been out in 2 months in hardcover, that's selling pretty well. It's sufficiently weird that I think it might be a mistake. So if you're interested in Mary Jane and you like it and you want to go buy it, go check Amazon. Maybe I didn't check other ebook retailers too, and see if you can go find it for $5.99. Pretty good deal.
It might or might not still be $5.99 by the time this show comes out.
Yes, that's right. I think it's actually, it's rare enough that we see this, that it's more likely that we're in a Cersei situation.
Yep, where it was like supposed to be $15.99, but somebody forgot the one and entered it as $5.99 and they haven't caught it yet.
Right. And that was hardcover, if I remember correctly, right? Like new release?
Oh, yeah. It was like, wasn't it the new release hardcover was listed at like $2.99? Yes. It was a bonkers just dropping of a zero.
Yeah. So anyway, that's Mary Jane. We got to take a sponsor break. And then we'll come back and talk about other book news things.
Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Gillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Gillian Linden, and thanks again to W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Rebecca. I'm not sure. Do we want to go through? Do we want to just point people? How do you want to handle the years so far stuff? What do you want to do with these?
I think let's just point people to them since we've done our own best of the year so far. And frankly, what else matters? Please don't send me emails. I'm joking. But Book Riot released our best books of 2021 so far. A big, juicy, beautiful collection of all kind of genres that came out between January 1st and June 30th, the true first half of the year. I am delighted. I mean, it's organized alphabetically, but I'm delighted to see that the top of the list is A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib, one of my faves. It's a big list, and it definitely prompted me to pick up some things and add some things to my stack that I had been kind of on the fence about, but seeing our contributors select some of these as best of the year so far nudged me over the line on some. So we'll have the link to that in the show notes. And then PW has the best-selling books of 2021 so far, which is more I mean, not more interesting than the best books, but it's more data than we get. And also pretty in line with the other sales stories that we've seen so far this year. So Kristen Hannah leading off, print bestsellers, number one for the four wins, 558,000 copies sold so far.
Print only, we should say.
In print, yeah. These are print bestsellers. The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse is in the second position. The Hill We Climb. This was a pleasant surprise. The Hill We Climb by Amanda Gorman. 455,000 copies.
Wow.
Good for her.
So we knew print runs, I think we talked about it earlier, both for Hill We Climb and for Winds, in excess of a million copies printed. Yes. I don't know how these things go. If you've burned through half of your print run, did you guess your print run right? You know, we still got these. I'm assuming these books are going to sell for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. What does the slope look like for those kinds of books? I think that would be interesting to see. I would guess The Hill We Climb has a little bit more, a little bit longer legs on it because it's a historical document sort of at this point. But pretty close at the top. They were within, you know, 15,000 copies. We jumped down 100K. Till the Hill We Climb. Boy, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, and The Horse. What a success story from Barnes & Noble's book. Because that was Barnes & Noble's Book of the Year pick at the end of 2019, if I remember. Is that
right? Yes, I believe so. It was either the end of 2019 or like the very beginning of 2020.
There's a term that gets used in the book world called, if you can make a book, make book. You know, which kinds of outlets, which kinds of marketing dollars, which kind of authors can make a book? Meaning that it can basically sell out its print run. It can make it into a thing. And last year's, was it World of Wonders? Was Barnes & Noble's last pick. So it was a little unclear like how much juice the Barnes & Noble Book of the Year was going to have. I think they started with an outlier, which is how this is going to work. But it's now a book that's, I think it's out there like, it's going to be out there like Winnie the Pooh or something
as long as
we're around.
It's just going to be in the water for a while. I was surprised to see number four is Atomic Habits by James Clear, which is a like self-help book about developing good habits. Good book and popular. I was just surprised to see like that placement for that, 396,000 copies. Then you get into The Four Agreements, which is sort of perpetually popular. The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. That's, you know, big book of fiction, 356,000. Matthew McConaughey is at number seven for Green Lights.
Yeah.
318, almost 319,000 copies. And that is surprising to me. I mean, I listened to this on audio and I thought it was like a pretty perfect experience for a Matthew McConaughey. It's exactly what you think a Matthew McConaughey book where he's largely like reading his diary to you is going to be. But I'm surprised that it sold that many copies in print. I'm deeply curious. Was this like a gift book that everybody got? I don't know. Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, still selling like hotcakes. Where the Crawdads Sing is number nine. And then number 12, The Body Keeps the Score, which is a book about trauma and how trauma gets stored in the body. That book has been out for a while and seems to just be continuing to climb up in public discussions and sort of cultural conversation about trauma. But 275,000 copies so far this year, right ahead of Barack Obama, A Promised Land at 274. And, you know, in this top 20, no longer is Becoming by Michelle Obama. So that's interesting.
Notable.
She's fallen out of the print bestsellers after, you know, having sold approximately 1 zillion books in a very short period of time. But that those are the notable ones to me. And 1984 is still on the list at number 18. I guess. Oh,
Signet. Just a cash cow.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I'm glad to see Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is on here. It's number 17, 231,000 copies. That's such an important book, and I'm always glad to see when something like that is
still
really
in hardcover,
selling.
Too, right? I think that's still a hardcover title. Just to go back up and note, I think we have one on the adult list and one on the YA. I think we have two TikTok books here. I think Song of Achilles and We Were Liars by E. Lockhart. I'm given to understand. That's the number two on the YA list. I'm given to understand we're having viral crying on TikTok booms.
This is what I understand as well.
So there it is. Again, like a lot of social media, the outliers really lie out. We're talking Madeline Miller, 304th, outsold where the, I mean, what else do I have to say? Outsold the Crawdads, which thank you, TikTok, by the way, for that alone.
Good job,
I know
kid.
Nothing
the kids
about
are
it.
All right, Jeff.
The kids are all right. And then We Were Liars outselling Stephanie Meyer by almost 100K. Mm-hmm. I also think They Both Die Thin by Ada Silvera. Is that a TikTok thing? That's not a new book.
Oh, maybe it is a TikTok thing. I don't know.
Yeah, boy. Now we're sounding like we're a thousand, we're as old as the Sequoias.
Listeners who are cooler than us, let us know.
Yeah, right, right. There was something else I was going to say. Yeah, the McConaughey, I think, is the big surprise to me. Other surprises. Stephen King's Later, which is number 20 on the adult list from Hard Case Crime. I think that's one of his that's only available in print. Like, if you're going to ring that one, you have to buy it on print, in print, so that it's not getting any fragmentation, cannibalization from audio or ebooks, so that, you know, everyone who wants a Stephen King book has to get there. The Children's Side, The Place You Go, number 2, 584,469, which means it would be the best, it's the second best-selling book overall, behind only Mothering Heights by Dave Pilkey, which it is hard to underestimate how big of a thing this is. 867,397. We talk about the Harry Potters of the world. We talk about the Twilights. We talk about the other things. But the Dog Man series
just
is the phenomenon of this decade. It just is. I don't know how to tell you. Yeah.
It's too bad we don't have annotated anymore, because I think a deep dive into Dog Man would be fascinating.
Yeah. Let's see. The Outsiders, right? S.E. Hinton. Just looking at, I like to see the ones that don't appear in the weekly publisher's weekly list, because they have rules that needs to be frontlist, blah, blah, blah. This includes backlist, which is the only time we really get to see this from Publishers Weekly. And since we don't regrettably have our own book scan account, which frankly is better for our productivity overall, that we do not have available to us to poke at. The Outsiders and The Giver,
the
top
Giver.
10 in YA. These books have been out 50 years at this point, 40 years.
I am fascinated by how The Giver landed here. And my only guess is, I think it's still pretty popular on summer reading lists
for
middle school and high school students. And I wonder if we're starting to see the impact of some of that on, now that it's July, on these bestsellers lists. Like, maybe everybody went out in June and bought their copies of The Giver for summer. Is The Giver getting big on TikTok? Somebody help me.
I think it's perpetually reading lists, summer reading. You know, it's just one of those classics. Now, again, what's interesting is to get to number 10 in YA, you only have to sell 150. I mean, only. This is a big book. To get to number 10 in YA, you have to sell 115,000 copies. To get to number 10 in adult, you got to do triple that.
Yep.
So it's easier for good-selling backlist titles to have a chance at the middle. I think the other notable one here, I was going to come back to it. I think only one TV adaptation boom here for Leigh Bardugo. Six of Crows, Siege and Storm, and Shadow and Bone all made the top 10 for YA. I don't see anything in adult that I would say that's because of TV or movie or adaptation.
Yeah, I don't think anything is. And I think it's interesting that on this adult bestsellers list, like, often what happens is the number one will be like far and away huge sales relative to everything else. And this is not that. The Four Winds is at 558,000. The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse is 543,000. Like, sometimes we're looking at whatever the number one title is sold like 750 or a million, and then everything below it was around this 500 or 400,000 mark. So it's just interesting to see, like, no one leader of the pack in a really standout kind of way, other than Mothering Heights and Dog Man. But Dav Pilkey, man,
it's a freight train. it's a squadron of freight trains,
on top of a Scrooge McDuck pile of money at this point.
No, runs on gold. Another notable thing here in its absence, I don't see a Reese book. I don't see a Jenna's Book Club book.
Oh,
I don't see a Oprah book. I don't see a Good Morning America. Do you?
No, not among the new ones. I don't think any of, let's see, the only new fiction on the adult print ones are The Four Winds. And the Midnight Library is relatively new.
Yeah, that was 2020.
Yeah, so no, I don't think those were picked by...
Right.
Reese hasn't made a book for us this year.
Again, maybe an outlier. Pick Crawdads. Turned out that was going to be a monster anyway. Maybe was The Promised Land an Oprah book? I mean, it doesn't really count because it's like putting a checker on a checker. It could. I would believe that maybe it was an Oprah book, but I don't.
Cast was an Oprah book, but I don't think. I don't think Cast needs Oprah to make it, but it was an Oprah book, and Oprah and Isabel Wilkerson did a podcast series. There are like 6 or 8 episodes of them discussing it. They did a whole like suite of content around it.
I think that's a borderline case for me to call that. I could believe that without an Oprah thing, that's not a thing. I also could believe that it didn't need it because Warmth of Other Sun was such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say at this point.
She was everywhere. Like every podcast I listened to had some reason to interview Isabel Wilkerson.
Why weren't we on? Speaking of trains, can we be on the caboose? Can we hang off the back of that?
We jump on the empty freight cars. Books, Jeff. We got a reason.
We think about this from time to time, like who would be an interesting interview to do? And it's almost like a muscle we need to stretch to use it all because most of the time we're like, I'm not sure. Author interviews on the whole, kind of tough. The kind of people you might want can be harder to get. Maybe, you know, the format, they don't know what we do. We should do some more of that in the future. Next time Isabel Wilkerson has a book that comes out, maybe we'll, yes, we'll try to see what we can do to get out there and do anything else notable here on the best-selling books of the year so far.
No, I don't think so.
To back up your earlier point about sales, though, or to add on to it, I think we said in our favorite reads of the year show, mm-hmm, that there was not a book of the year so far. Like we couldn't really think of what the book of the year would be. I think this bears that out. I think, mm-hmm, this is Exhibit A, and there isn't really the book of the year. Now, if I had to pick one, let's do this. If you had to pick a book of the year based on only these books.
Oh, interesting.
Are you going somewhere? What do you have to pick?
Where am I going? Well, the one that I think you have mentioned a couple of times that you see popping up in a lot of places is The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab. And that's number 16 on this list. I don't think that's high enough to be a book of the year. And then The Four Winds is like so widely read, but it's not, it doesn't make like a Kristen Hanna historical fiction doesn't make like a cultural splash to be a book of the year. So maybe Matt Haig, The Midnight Library. I've seen a lot of people. If I have to pick a book from this list, it's the highest ranked, newest one that I've seen a lot of people talk about and had a lot of affection for in late 2020, early 2021. I think that was like a comfort read for a lot of folks during the really difficult days of COVID. So maybe if I have to pick one, it's that one, I guess. But maybe Greenlights is like a stealthy, Matthew McConaughey is like a secret book of the year.
If he runs for the governor of Texas and wins based on the back of Greenlights, I guess you entered in some nuance I hadn't considered that I was thinking from my head that a book of the year needs to be a book published in 2021.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so, because Addie LaRue and Midnight Library are both 2020 books, but if we're going to expand our mind, which we did for Such a Fun Age, we made a exception that was, you know, the
and doesn't Where the Crawdads Sing was published in the fall of a year and didn't get big until January of the following year.
And I would have been an idiot to say that's not the book of the year because it came out 3 months ago. No, I mean, literally. Yeah. So that's,
So that would have been the book of 2019 when Crawdads was big? I think it was.
Oh boy, the pandemic has done such weird things to the short-term calendar memory.
I think it was. It came out in the fall of 2018, and it got big in winter of 2019.
I might go one of two ways. I think there's a case to be made for The Hill We Climb.
Mm.
If you're going to look at Delta over replacement book, which is poetry, it's the book of the year, right? If you're comparing it not to all books, but to the category from which it arises. From which it climbs, so to speak. Also, it has a cultural weight because remember, sales are only part of our idea of what you need to be book of the year. Now, probably more people have quote unquote read The Hill We Climb just because of people who watched the inauguration and read the poem. Know who could pick Amanda Gorman out of a lineup is interesting compared to a lot of people on this list. People can pick out King, Obama, McConaughey, Gorman. And that's the list?
I mean, nobody can pick Delia Owens out of a lineup, but
Grisham, maybe? Grisham spends most of the time picking his friends out of lineups.
People
did
you
pick like that
Glenn
joke?
Doyle.
Did you like the joke?
I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I got it. It's a deep cut.
That's a deep cut. We have to go back several years for that one. Yeah, I don't think anybody else you can really pick out of a lineup. So I don't know what the author's Q rating has to do with anything. Mm-hmm. But Gorman would certainly pass that test. Now, you're good, astute listeners out there, which there are at least a half dozen, will say, well, Jeff and Rebecca, why not Mothering Heights?
I mean, Mothering Heights could be the book of the year. We just tend to think of the book of the year as adult fiction, typically. Typically, it's adult fiction. What big novel broke out?
Yeah. It can be kids or YA, but you almost need an adaptation for adults to watch. Or, right?
Yeah, you need like an adult audience. You know, like if adults were out talking about how Mothering Heights, Dogman number 10 right. changed their lives and everyone has to read it, I think it would be on the table. YA could totally be on the table for this.
If it sold the same number of copies, but like some adults were reading it just for funsies on their own, like a meaningful number, right. it could be book of the year. I agree with that. Right. I will go with
yeah.
that.
Like, yeah. Right, like if I, a joyfully child-free person, were like, I got to get my hands on Mothering Heights because everybody's mm-hmm. reading it. All my friends are reading it. We all like it. I think that's a different kind of story about a book than just, you know, almost a million people buying it for their kids.
Yeah. And the earlier examples of that phenomenon, which we're kind of creating on the fly, this kind of rule or stricture, is the Hunger Games of the world. There's a world and there's you and I reading, you read Hunger Games contemporaneously,
oh, yeah.
right?
Yes.
But you weren't reading YA before that? Like, was that a crossover kind of thing? Like, it became enough of a thing that you needed to
yes.
read it?
It was, yeah. I had never been a big YA reader. I'm still not a huge YA reader, but I think it was Twilight first and then The Hunger Games that I was like, well, these are a big yeah. enough cultural deal that I have to read these. And certainly the year Twilight came out, it was the book of the year.
Yeah. Yeah, Mothering Heights is a giant fish in a relatively small pond at this point. And it hasn't quite made the leap to swim in other, you know, the cultural knowledge pond. That's not to say it couldn't get there. Things have done this before on the Winnie the Pooh kids book side. Maybe as the people
true.
Who grew up with Mothering Heights and Dogman have kids that are on their own and they look forward to reading them and they become on the children's bestseller list for a million years. Maybe we'd have to, but that by definition is not book of the year. That's going to be just part of the constellation of books that are in our ecosystem.
I have never seen a Dogman book. So do you think Dogman has the potential to be like a multi-generational enduring fave, like a Winnie the Pooh kind of situation? Will we be talking about Dogman in 40 years?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why is that I think they're fun. My son loves them. My daughter really likes them. She's now old enough she can read them on their own. They very much like them. They read them all and collected them all, and they will read them. I think the humor style story doesn't transcend being 10 in a way that, frankly, something like Winnie the Pooh can transcend.
Right.
You read that as an adult, it means something different. I think a lot of like randomness and fart jokes and like all that kind of stuff is funny, but you kind of get it by the time you're 25, 35, 45, 55, where reading Winnie the Pooh with my children gives something to me in that mm-hmm. experience. I'm not going to read it on my own, but I'm certainly probably not going to read them Mothering Heights because like, let's sit down and read this together, gather around the fireplace and have a family reading moment in
yeah.
that kind of way. It's good for everybody. I might read it to them. We might enjoy it together, but I don't think it's going to be. Now you might say, Jeff, you just said earlier in the podcast 3 years ago that you don't do that with Dr. Seuss, and yet it sells. So maybe it could that be
yeah.
the counterexample. Winnie the Pooh's also not on these lists, I guess.
There's a kind of required nostalgia factor to be
yeah.
an enduring fave, like Oh, the Places You'll Go ends up. And I think that you're onto something there with will this transcend the age that of the like intended reader? Because if you ask it of like in 10 years when your kid who's 10 now is 20, mm-hmm. will he be looking at is he going to be climbing up the ladder to his bookshelf? Like, you know what? I really
right.
just want to dig into Dogman number 10 today.
That's right. That's right. That's
just
right.
for a nostalgia hit. And it sounds like probably not.
And I think there's a meaningful difference here, especially, you know, you think about the difference between the Babysitter's Club, which a lot of people read and really liked as young people, but they're not reading them now. Whereas Anne of Green Gables, you read mm-hmm. it around the same age, but people will go back and read that as adults and have a different kind of experience with it. I feel like Mothering Heights is more on the Babysitter's Club side than the Anne of Green Gables side, but time will tell.
Yeah.
Boy, there's a lot more meat on that bone than I thought. We got to do one last sponsor break and come back and tell me about some good news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
All right, Rebecca, you added this one.
Yeah.
Good news.
This is good news. This is a may your efforts continue succeeding over in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
In Portland. Portland Public Schools will no longer be using a set of history books in their classrooms after a parent complained on the book's racist portrayals of Black people and Native Americans. The parent's name is Danielle Blake. At the time, she was the parent of a fifth grader at Capitol Hill Elementary, and she complained about a book called A History of U.S. I think it's U.S. Maybe it's A History of Us, to her teacher's daughter back in 2019. This is being reported in the Willamette Week by Aaron Mesh, and they first reported on it in 2019 as well. And this month, a district administrator told Blake that a committee had recommended that the books no longer be used in the Portland Public School classrooms and that all school principals have been informed of that recommendation. The district administrator said that the text contains historical inaccuracies, which may cause harm to students of color in particular. So really glad to see this. They acknowledge, but the parent here, Danielle Blake, says the decision took far too much time and effort to obtain, but she's happy with the outcome. And she says that most significant to me and the reason stated for their findings is the fact that they acknowledge the harm that it does, particularly to educators and students of color, that they're taking a risk by openly acknowledging this. And I see it as a meaningful step. So good on you, Danielle Blake, for sounding the alarm and expressing concern about this. And not only may your efforts succeed, but good on the Portland Public Schools folks who took this step. And I think Danielle Blake is right here about a thing that I wish she weren't right about, which that it is a risk in our political climate today for schools to openly acknowledge this kind of thing, especially in the conversations that are happening around critical race theory. And it's really important to keep saying when we see it that this is a racist depiction in a book, this is inaccurate, it's harmful to our students. It's not just harmful to students and teachers of color, it's harmful to everyone to be given these messages that are not correct. And really wonderful to see educators thinking about harm reduction and thinking about their place here. So you're our heroes of the week, Danielle Blake and Portland Public School.
link in the show notes as always, bookriot.com/listen. I'm not going to read some of the passages that were especially notable here because I don't want to put them into the ether and trigger warnings of all kinds here. But I think it's interesting. I'm not sure 10 years ago, does this get flagged? You know, it's like, yeah. I think maybe not, though it certainly should be. I'd be curious to hear if this kind of thing would be kept up. Portland in general and the school level, I've been really impressed with how they tend to handle situations like this. Now, again, mileage may vary. Probably tomorrow there'll be some horrible story in each school by school, district by district. But compared to what I was used to as a kid, the sensitivity, proactiveness about representation in what the teachers select, what school boards select, what on reading lists is really great. And I'm sure it has a long way to go still, and there are things that I don't recognize that could be improved upon. But I guess what I'm a long way of saying, I'm not surprised that this happened. It's not a huge surprise that Portland did the right, what I see as the right thing in this particular situation. Though, as Blake mentions, it probably could have gone a little faster. Welcome to government administration and school boards to some degree. There's only so fast that some of them can go. I think it's also the other thing that can of worms is here. She says, you know, I don't know why it took so long for a parent's voice concerns to be heard. I think y'all have heard us talk enough about what kinds of parents tend to be complaining on these sorts of situations that it works both ways. And I think how much parents can and can't be or shouldn't be a voice in the curriculum is not as easy an answer as you might think. Is it okay when you agree with what the parent is doing? Well, that's not about parental participation. That's what the content of what they're saying. It's just a hairy, very, very difficult and hairy subject. But I'm glad to see this seems to me like a very clear case of a change that needed to be made. That's our show. As always, you can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. I don't think we have any particular ask there this week. I don't know if I want more stuff about historical fiction, but I guess I do. Because if there's another thing that we missed, another wrinkle and wrinkle to get in there, we really want to hear about it. We'll be back next week with more stories and words about words here on the Book Riot Podcast. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.